going, I'll start by sort of echoing something Luther said about the how amazing it was to work with this archive. And it really made me think about the ways in which these new digital initiatives, like the Civil War governors of Kentucky, really increase accessibility, right? And they make sources available to people in common, right? I did all this research for my group, sitting at my desk at home, which is great, and it's a relatively sort of new phenomenon. But really sort of what I was dealing with in this paper and also my larger book project, which deals with the sort of the similar issue, is not so much questions of accessibility, but the way in which we still, regardless of how accessible these digital archives make these sources to us, there are still questions about the limits of the archive that still persist. Questions like what kind of histories and what kind of knowledge do particular archives produce about the subjects that they are dealing with? And it really sort of made me realize that archives are not neutral repositories, right? We often think of them and speak of the archive. Right? The archive is where we go, the archive contains our information, it's the vessel, it's the building, right, where our stuff that we work with as historians is housed or contained. But really, archives are much more active, right? I'm beginning to think of them as much more sort of active, that they actively construct, right, images, pictures, narratives, and knowledge about the subjects that are contained within. And so these questions about the archive's limits, what kind of knowledge and narratives that the archives produce, they won't be solved, or they won't be answered by simply finding more sources, right? Because the more sources you find, they're still creating particular kinds of knowledge about these subjects. And so that's how I sort of came to this, this particular paper about a woman named Caroline, who was a fugitive slave, who entered Kentucky sometime in 1862 and was subsequently accused of infanticide. And for those of you who have read Patrick and Matt Holbert's phenomenal blog about these documents that are in the governor's papers, they sort of do a really great job of sort of outlining the case against Caroline and the pardon campaign that emerges from that. So I won't go into it except to sort of say she is subsequently, she does get a pardon from the governor. But where I came to this really sort of interesting case, I wanted to know what happened to her afterwards. Right? What happens when she's released from jail? Where does she go? What does she do? What kind of possibilities are open to her? What kind of obstacles lay in her path? And those are the kind of questions that aren't going to be, there are no documents to tell us. What happens to her. So I have to kind of employ what historian Paula Bass calls a disciplined imagination, right? But to take what sources are available and read them very carefully and apply new questions, right? But I'm not going to find new sources probably about Caroline Looks, and I don't think they're there. So I have to, and a lot of us who are working with people who are interested in people and trying to reconstruct the lives of people who didn't leave a big paper trail. Particularly the paper trail that we do have about them, they didn't create, they didn't have a hand in creating, right? So someone like Caroline, an enslaved woman, all the documents we have are created by other people about her. They're created either by the people who were trying to prosecute her for poisoning this child, or they're trying to get her a pardon. I'm going to talk a little bit in a minute about the two sort of contradictory images of Caroline that emerge from that archive. So we have to take what I have and apply sort of new questions and think about and see if there are different ways to sort of interpret these sources and fill in the gaps and silences that are there about who this woman really was, what she may have been thinking, what kind of life she might have been envisioning for herself, and what may have happened to her after she does win her pardon. And is released from jail. what we sort of know about her, like I said, from these two kind of groups of sources, on the one hand, sort of the prosecution of her case, pardon campaign on her behalf, what emerges, this picture of Caroline that we have, is what historian Marisa Fuentes calls a mutilated historicity, right? She emerges as sort of, on the one hand, she's a villain, right? She's villainized, she's portrayed as this conniving, manipulative, dangerous woman, right, who has been given shelter, you know, in a home, a white home in Louisville, after she follows Wells' army back into Kentucky in 1862, and you know, she betrays, right, that care and protection that's been given her by, you know, plotting and carrying out this heinous murder of a young child. On the other hand, in the pardon papers, the image that we see from her is one of an ignorant contraband, right, who is bordering on being an imbecile. And the pardon papers often, you know, make her case by saying she's too ignorant to have done this, right? She's too ignorant to lie about it, right? I've asked her, and the ministers and the various attorneys say, you know, I've asked her if she did this, and she can't even comprehend, right, what is going on. She doesn't understand the legal process. She doesn't understand how someone could say this about her. They also portray her as being very young, right? She's just a child almost. She's a young girl. They say she may be 18 to 20. No one exactly knows how old she is. And so what emerges from these pardon papers, even though they're created by people who are sympathetic and are wanting to help her and believe she's been treated unjustly, we still get a very flattened image of who this woman was and what she may have been thinking about, what was happening to her. So she has this, I really think that the term, the mutilated historicity of this person, is really quite striking and really epitomizes, I think, what Marisa Fuentes is getting at about the limits of the archive and what kind of knowledge is produced about people, particularly enslaved people, like Caroline. So again, for the sort of broad outlines of her case and the ins and outs of the intricacies of that, I again point you to Patrick and Matt's really fantastic blog. And you know, it struck me that, you know, particularly for sort of the people who are appealing on her behalf, you know, for them, Caroline represents in some ways sort of this new birth of freedom, right, that's underway by 1863 when her pardon campaign really is sort of getting underway. You know, they portray her as this very pitiable product of slavery for whom the government, they believe, now bears a responsibility, right? She's a contraband, and they call her contraband frequently. The war had loosened her chains, but it hadn't cast them off completely. And they're really insistent about her particular kind of vulnerability, right, as being a fugitive from slavery. And at one point, Reverend McKee, who was writing on her behalf, he says, no one cared anything about her. And she had such a strong prejudice to me in the mere fact of being a contraband. And of course, you know, the problem of fugitive slaves and contrabands in Kentucky fleeing from the slave states and further south during the war does cause a kind of crisis, right? If not in actuality, people sort of believe that it does, right? There's a sense that the state is being invaded by these people. What are we going to do with them? And of course, in 1863, even though the Emancipation Proclamation has gone into effect in January, Kentucky is still a slave state, right? Because the Emancipation Proclamation did not apply to the slaves in Kentucky. So when Caroline steps out of jail October of 1863, you know, just a few blocks away, one of Louisville's largest slave markets, right? And it's still active. And they are, in fact, selling people like Caroline who are fugitives, who are runaways, either from intrastate, right, from farms and other places outside of Louisville, who are obviously coming to Louisville, either hoping to get across the Ohio River into the free states of the north, or just seeking refuge in the city's larger population. You know, so she's still a slave, right? When she steps out of jail. And so, trying to sort of reconstruct what the possibilities were for her. One thing I think, when we're trying to do this is you have to pay really close attention to the physical landscape and the geography in which these people are existing and are having to navigate. So I did a lot of reading on sort of wartime Louisville, doing lots of maps, trying to pinpoint where that old the old city and county, Jefferson County jail was, its proximity to these slave markets that are operating, its proximity to the river, to try to think about what are the landmarks, right? How is this woman's physical existence bounded, right? What are the limits of her actual physical movement in the city to try to figure out where would she go? What possibly might she have done it? To try to figure out. And of course, she could have gone to and taken refuge with the city's very large free black population. Louisville had the largest free black population out west of Baltimore at the time, and a very well-established free black community. But because of the influx of soldiers into the city, Louisville is a wartime city, it's heavily garrisoned, and a lot of those soldiers are sort of policing or backing up the city police in policing the lives and the activities of free blacks. So their movement is incredibly restricted. I think it's most likely that Caroline went back into the employ of some white family or white individual, possibly some of the people who had been campaigning on her behalf, because as a fugitive slave, she's required to be employed by a white person who is basically signing a bond with the county to sort of give her a place to live and a place to work. Otherwise, she has to sit in jail or possibly face being sold. So these are the kind of options that are open to her. Another thing I noticed in the pardon documents that I was sort of trying to follow up was a line in one of the petitions in which she bases her plea as, I forget exactly the wording she used, as a woman and a mother, right? So she says, I couldn't have harmed this child because I'm a woman and a mother. And nowhere else in any of these documents do they mention her family life, any kind of children. So I tried to sort of think about, well, if she had children, where are they? And this sort of brings me back to this other question about where did she come from, right? You sort of run up against this unreliability of the archive, right? Because not even her name or age are really reliable in what they're given. She has two different names in the various papers. Sometimes she's called Carolyn Dennett. Otherwise, sometimes she's called Carolyn Denman. So going through some the ancestry archives, trying to find slaveholders in Tennessee and Alabama, sort of on this route that Wells' army would have taken after the Battle of Shiloh and then back up before the Battle of Perryville. There were no Dennett slaveholders in this area, but there were Denman slaveholders, both in Tennessee and northern Alabama. And there was one slaveholder in particular that I sort of honed in on, which is this guy named J.C. Denman, who's living in Jefferson County, Tennessee. And he owned one female slave who, in 1860, was aged 28. Now, this is older than Caroline's estimated age, and the pardon papers is about 20 to 22, but really neither number is more reliable than the other. Okay, because like I said, the pardoners are trying to make her appear innocent, right? And the younger she is, right, the more innocent they feel that she might appear. The older she is, the more sort of seasoned or wily, she might come off as. In sort of following up this lead, the Adams plantation, there are three male slaves, one female slave, and three children. So, and this is where the discipline imagination comes in, right? So I'm thinking, this is Caroline. Let's imagine that this is her, right? And these three children are most likely hers because they were young. They were like 6, 5, 3. They were young children. Let's imagine that these are her children, right? This is what she's talking about when she says, you know, I'm a woman and a mother. You know, where did those children go? Did she leave them there? When she left, would she have left and followed the army and just left them there? Would she have taken them with her? And so then we have to sort of broaden out and think about the larger experience of being a fugitive during the Civil War. Of course, we know, you know, runaways during the antebellum period, during slavery, by and large were male. Women didn't run away as frequently, in large part because of the risk of trying to take children and not wanting to leave children with them. But during the war, women were more likely to run away with their children, to take their families, to follow the army. So it wouldn't be sort of out of bounds to think that she did that. But they're obviously not with her in Louisville, or at least the documents don't make any indication that these children are with her. They could have died, right? Being a fugitive on the road is very, because of disease and other sort of issues of exposure, are very dangerous. So she could have taken them with her, she could have left them there. You know, we're not going to know for certain the answers to these questions, but I think sort of the important thing that I'm coming to with this little project is that we have to try to think about it and at least imagine and ask the questions if we are to understand or get closer to understanding who Caroline really was, what decisions she faced, right, when she is contemplating leaving her farm or her plantation, you know, we call it plantations for a small operation, when she's thinking about leaving, or when she steps out of jail in Louisville, to try to get a better understanding of what the world around her was like and what her expectations and desires were.